You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs here at the Library Foundation, and it's wonderful to see you all here this evening. Thank you for supporting the Library Foundation, the nonprofit that gives vital assistance to the Los Angeles Public Library, resulting in free programs for thousands of Angelenos. To the members here, thank you for being here. And if you are not a member, we hope that you will consider joining. Please find any of my colleagues in the lobby during the book signing. I'm sure they will be able to tell you more about the foundation and how to join. Before introducing tonight's program, I want to just briefly mention that I will be planning on doing, what I'd be planning on doing this year with programming. I'm going to be introducing a theme, which will be the theme of home. The question is, what is home and what is home to us? The subject is broad enough to encompass policy, design, relationships, food, shelter, our environment. The list is extensive. And in a loose way, all of our programs will touch in some aspect on this theme. We're not trying to answer the question, but by proposing it, we hope to make all of us think more deeply about the concept and how it resonates with each of us. This brings me to this evening, to those making the laws that guide us, American oligarchs, looks at the Trumps and the Kushners rise to extreme wealth and power, and then to the White House. Andrea Bernstein has given us a deep understanding of the families, their origins, their dealings, their strategies. Quoted in a review of American oligarchs in the New York Times, Bernstein says, "The act of telling the story is itself an action, a chance, a tilt toward the future. I still believe in truth and facts. I still believe that telling reinforces those things. I believe that in telling, there is hope." Andrea Bernstein is an intrepid journalist who has covered six elections, including the 2016, and broken numerous stories surrounding the Trumps. She is the Peabody DuPont Columbia Award-winning co-host of the acclaimed WNYC podcast, ProPublica podcast, Trump, Inc. Bernstein's writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The New York Magazine, and on NPR. She'll be in conversation with Kristen Muller, KPCC's chief content officer. Muller oversees the station's programming, podcasting, and its impressive local journalism. She leads an award-winning team of hosts, reporters, and producers, helping to shape Angelenos' knowledge of what is currently affecting our city. Please help me in welcoming Andrea Bernstein and Kristen Muller. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. But I want to start tonight by asking what may seem like an obvious question, and that is, why Kushners and Trumps? Why not just Trumps? Because I'm sure you could fill six to dozen volumes just on him alone.
Well, I wanted to tell the multi-generational saga of these two entwined families. And the way that the stories relate to each other and reflect each other and echo each other gives each story more resonance. And I wanted to write a book that would be a great read and a good story and would tell us something about ourselves. And having the two families together felt like the best way to do it. So this was something that I just sort of wanted to do from the very beginning. It's hard to say how that particular idea hit me, but it became clear that I wanted to tell the multi-generational stories because a multi-generational narrative is, I mean, it's the basis for a lot of novels and movies, and it's a satisfying story. But it's also a revealing way to tell a story, and it's a great way to tell a history.
So let's go back in time, three generations. Let's start with the Trump part of the story. Friedrich Trump, who comes to America from Germany, not Sweden. If you take away nothing else, Germany, not Sweden. Tell us why he came and what he did.
So he came because of inheritance laws, and well, for two reasons. One was that Germany was in a state of constant war, and he didn't want to join the military. And also because he was not the oldest son in his family, so he wasn't going to inherit any land, really. He was going to inherit a very invaluable piece of land, as in not valuable. And so he takes the boat to New York, and he arrives in New York Harbor, and he works as a barber for a little while in New York, but he's not really making money. So he goes west. He goes to first Seattle and then to the Yukon. And he's in the hospitality business. So this is when there's a lot of prospecting going on, mining. And he doesn't work in any of those industries, but he figures out how to profit from those industries by basically setting up establishments in areas where he knows a lot of prospectors are going to be going through. So he does this first in Seattle, and he sells... And he does it. Then he does it in the Yukon. And he sells food and liquor and access to sex. And he makes a lot of money. Surprise. He has a big nest egg. And he comes back to New York after doing this for several years. And a lot of people in the gold rush, most people lost money. But Friedrich Trump made money because he had this ancillary business. And there's a whole bunch of Friedrich Trump business practices that have become very familiar to me as Trump family business practices. One of which is that he wanted to set up a restaurant in the Cascade Mountains, but you could get free land, free as in appropriated land from native populations, but free to him if you said you were going to be mining. So he said he was going to be mining. However, he had no intention of mining. He was going to build a restaurant, which we know because the paperwork shows that at the same time he was saying he was going to mine the land, he was also ordering the lumber to build the restaurant, which you weren't allowed to do if you were mining the land. So that was a practice that has become increasingly common to me, or as I've studied it, Donald Trump's business. But he goes back to New York, and he moves to Queens at a time when Queens, New York, which is across the East River from Manhattan, is inaccessible to Manhattan. There's no bridge, there's no tunnel, but they're about to build a bridge. And that means that all of the land that Friedrich Trump is about to buy is about to become incredibly valuable. And that's how the Trump family business is born.
So you've got Friedrich, who has a son named Fred.
Friedrich has a son named Fred.
And Fred learns what and takes what from Friedrich.
So Friedrich dies young. He dies in the Spanish influenza outbreak of in the teens. He dies in 1917. And Friedrich, Fred Trump, the son, is a teenager. And he starts in the housing business, and he does stuff like he... builds a house, and then he sells the house, and then he uses the proceeds to buy another house. But it's not scaled up. And in the mid-1930s, he realizes that he needs to get access to the political culture in New York. Because in New York, I mean, even at that time, land was extremely valuable and very regulated, which meant that if you wanted to make money as a real estate developer, you had to build those political connections. Now, let me say, everybody who does real estate in New York and New Jersey understands that plying your political connections is the way to increase the value of your land. The Trumps, Fred and then Donald, did it in a way off the scales way. And so the first thing that he does is he gets a piece of a company that's going bankrupt and... from a Brooklyn judge who's controlled by the Brooklyn political machine. He starts to give donations, and he goes to the dinners, but he does more. He hires people that are attached to the political party. He hires their lawyer. He hires their insurance broker, and he cultivates these ties. So when the Federal Housing Administration in the late 1930s and 40s is handing out packages of mortgage insurance, Fred Trump is exceedingly well-positioned because he's cultivated political ties with the local Federal Housing Administrator. So he gets an extra big chunk. And this is what makes Fred Trump a millionaire in 1940s dollars, was his political ties. And it's something that his son Donald really learned from him, was it wasn't about just making donations. It was about forging a lasting impression with the political machine that meant every time they had to make a decision about a tax giveaway or how high he could build his buildings or anything like that, that he had the insider connection. Some of you may remember when he gave his acceptance speech at the Republican convention, he said, "Nobody knows the system better than me." And that may be the truest thing he's ever said.
Well, I want to just jump on the other timeline for a minute, because the Kushner family, you pick up the Kushner family story in around this time, 1930s, in Europe, Poland, and it's a very different situation for them.
It's a very different situation. I mean, the interesting thing about Friedrich Trump, because it's not just, my book is actually about what's happening to our democracy and wealth inequality and the things that we have done badly as a nation to make our society more unequal and more subject to the whims of very, very wealthy people. And when Friedrich Trump arrived in New York, it was the Gilded Age. So it, in some ways, was similar to our own times. There was vast wealth inequality, and there were very few families who had so much money. And not only did they have so much money, but they had ostentatious wealth. So, for example, there was this restaurant in New York that people liked to go to where they had an artificial lake and swans swimming around. And there were actual gold toilets in people's houses.
Wow.
So that was the Gilded Age. But when Friedrich Trump arrived, there was still social elasticity. Because there was a lot of, because there was sort of less entrenched wealth than, say, in Europe, you could still change your social class. And one of the things that's happened under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 is it's become much harder for people to change their social class. So what Donald Trump's grandfather did, fewer people can do now as a result of a lot of things, but also as a result of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, which was basically Donald Trump's only major piece of legislation that he got passed through Congress. So the Kushner family kind of enters the story at a very different moment. This is a moment where two things are happening that are sort of hard to reconcile. One is that there's incredible destruction. There's the destruction that was wrought by the global depression and also by the wars. And people are losing everything. But the paradoxical result of that is that society becomes much more equal, and we sort of live with the results of that for a long time. But the Kushner family very much lost everything. Jared Kushner's grandmother came from a sort of middle to upper middle class family in northeast Poland, and they were furriers. And for a while, things seemed great. There was a big civic life. There was a synagogue. There was a theater. People would gather in the square on Shabbat. And they began to hear these stories about Germans coming into southern Poland to kill the Jews. And their reaction was, who would do that? How could that be true? They just rejected it, basically. And then the Soviet Union takes over, and then the Nazis march in. And for a while, things are not so terrible. The Jews cannot walk on the sidewalks. They have to wear yellow stars. But then one Christmas or one December day, very cold day, the tens of thousands of Jews from the town are gathered into a courtyard. And they're told, you go to the left and you go to the right. And one way was to live and one way was to die. And the people that were told to die were put in a line to get on trucks, and the trucks were going to take them, as they learned later, to trenches where they would stand on the outside of the trenches and be shot and fall into their own graves. And they're on the line to get onto the trucks, and somebody says, is anybody here a furrier? And Jared Kushner's grandmother's mother puts up her hand, and she says, well, we are furriers. So the German army needed someone to make fur hats and coats to clothe them as they marched into Moscow. And we know how that worked out. But they wanted furriers. So they pulled the Kushners out of the line, and Jared Kushner's great-grandmother still wasn't sure if they were going to live. So she said to her oldest daughter, you run so one of us might live. And that daughter ran, and she was caught, and she was put on the trucks, Esther Kushner. She died that day. So they're living in this town, and more and more people are being killed. And for a long time, the Jews there thought, there must be some reason why we're surviving. We must be able to provide a service to the Nazis, or they're not going to survive the winter. We'll be okay. But then they realize they're not going to be okay. So they dig a tunnel underneath the barbed wire. It takes them 3 months, and they have bags of dirt that they hide underneath the beds and in the walls so the Nazis won't know that they're building a tunnel. And they escape. Everybody gets out. Some of the people who have crawled through the tunnel run in the wrong direction and get caught by the Nazis. But Jared Kushner's grandmother makes it out. She makes it to the forest along with her sister and her father. She loses her brother. She's lost her sister. Her mother was murdered by the Nazis. And they live in the forest for 9 months. And then they come back to the town, and it's a wasteland after the war. So they decide they need to escape the Soviet Union. So they basically, she gets on a train to Budapest, saying that they're Greeks. And they get to Budapest, and she meets up with her with someone she knew before the war, Yesil Berkowitz, and they get married. And together, they continue. They sneak around borders, and they take trains, and they walk, and they get to Italy, and they get to a refugee camp, and they're stuck there for 4 years. And they cannot get into the United States, because even after the Holocaust, this week is the 75th anniversary of Auschwitz, and even after what people knew, the U.S. immigration laws were so restrictive, they couldn't get visas, there was a quota. So they hit on the idea that Jared Kushner's grandfather, Yesil Berkowitz, is going to pose as his father-in-law's son, because immigration laws were more favorable for family units structured in that way. And they do that, and Yesil Berkowitz changes his name to Joe Kushner. And they've lost everything, including every single document they ever had, so there is no record to suggest otherwise. So they arrive in the United States with $2 in their pocket and a new name. And like the Trump family, they benefit from the fact that Joe Kushner is a carpenter and he becomes a builder and he starts to buy land. And this is a time that the US government is pouring money into home building. It's after the war. People are restarting families. The government is putting money into a highway bill. And so that people can get to those homes, and it is a great time to be a builder. Joe Kushner, by the time he dies in the 1980s, is a millionaire many times over. So that's the origin story of the Kushner family.
But it's an extraordinary story, and you have to believe, and you document it well. I mean, you actually find the records from the Immigrant Aid Society, the case files for this family, and there were some interesting, I don't know if you can quote it off the top of your head, but there were some interesting observations by the caseworker about the Kushner family, which I thought also were...
Yeah, this was an incredibly vivid finding, and it was an incredible thing when I got this file. It was a file that was written in 1949 by the Hebrew Immigrants Aid Society, and they had... no one had really looked at this file in 70 years. And it had notes from that moment. And that was the amazing thing, because I really did want to write a history. And to have someone who has personal observations in real time, I mean, everybody here from the library will understand, like, that is such a great finding. And they talked about the things that Joe Kushner said and how he was worried about whether his father could find a job and everybody could find a job. And also at one point they said that they seemed very concerned that they would not get aid that they were supposed to get, that they were very worried about that and wanted to make sure that they were going to get their share. So there's a lot of the documents that are quoted in the book. I hope you read it.
That's amazing.
But it was an extraordinary finding.
So around the same time, you talk about how Kushner is benefiting from this federal stimulus, essentially. And again, now back to the Trump timeline, same thing's happening.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that, because it's...
Yeah, so, I mean, in parallel, what is happening is that Fred Trump, working the system, is being able to draw down all these federal dollars. And at one point, sort of resonant tonight, he's called before the Senate Banking Committee because they think his business practices are improper. And they wonder if there's been some kind of undue influence brought to bear on federal housing administrators, and they are worried about corruption in the agency because there's many millions of dollars are flowing through, and there's a lot of discretion on these local administrators. So they call on the developers, Fred Trump among them, and they say to him, "Why, when you were trying to get a loan, did you value this property at a high price, which made it more favorable, but when you wanted to pay taxes, you valued it at a low price?" Which is something that in our podcast we've been reporting. I mean, Donald Trump is basically doing that as we speak, or maybe not as we speak, but recently his business has done that. And they're really upset about these practices. And Fred Trump flies back to New York, and the Senate Banking Committee issues a report, and it says these kinds of practices were outright misrepresentation, but nothing happens. There are no consequences other than that for Fred Trump. And so what does he do? He continues on what the New York Times has uncovered as a practice of using 295 separate revenue streams to deliver $1 billion adjusted for inflation to his children tax-free, including $400 million to Donald Trump. And one of the things that we keep seeing with the Trump family business is each time they escape consequences, they find more ways to break the rules and to enhance their own power.
And simultaneously, they're kind of bending, you know, like these federal policies, they're kind of bending to their will. It's like some...
Yeah. I mean, they really were very good at sort of making the system work for them. And one of the earliest lawsuits that Donald Trump was involved in was when the U.S. Department of Justice, sues them because they say that they're discriminating in their housing, in their homes that they have, in their developments in Brooklyn and Queens, and they're not renting to blacks. And there are a lot of depositions that where people say, yes, they wouldn't rent to any black tenants. And so Donald Trump goes out to a club, the kind of club, he says, where you expect someone to walk in with three Swedish models on their arm. Le Club, it's called. And he meets a lawyer named Roy Cohn, who he hires to defend him in this Justice Department lawsuit. And he loves Roy Cohn. They settle the lawsuit, and they admit no wrongdoing, but they promise not to discriminate in the future.
Okay, so a little bit of a sidetrack, but what's up with Sweden? Why Sweden?
So Donald Trump definitely has a very big interest in Sweden. So during the war, when Fred Trump, one of the things that he did was he also built housing in Norfolk for various military purposes and families there during the war. And he didn't want to, it was during the war, he didn't want to say he was from German parentage, so he started saying he was Swedish. And this was something that Donald Trump said many, many times, he was Swedish. And in so many early newspaper profiles, people picked it up. They said, Donald Trump, who is Swedish. And he would say that when his father was eulogized in 1999 by, yes, Rudy Giuliani.
No, wow.
The New York Post reported that he was Swedish. But Donald Trump has no Swedish ancestry. He just has a big interest in Sweden.
Wow.
You know, because, well, also Scandinavia. I mean, some of you may remember when he said his thing about shithole countries. He was like, why don't we get people from Norway instead?
So, and I think the New York Times was the one that broke this, but essentially, Fred transfers all his wealth through all these illegal tax schemes, and at age, I think it's like age two, Donald's earning like hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Yes.
So one of the questions that I thought came out of that, and you addressed in your book, it's like, did he really, given that he's kind of starting on third base, did he really make the family fortune that much bigger, or was it just about making it glitzier?
Well, of course, we don't know how big the family fortune is because we cannot see his tax returns.
Good point.
So it's a hard question to answer, but one of the things that I do show in my book is how all of the ways that the Trump and Kushner families devised to transfer wealth through the generations. And this has become a social problem. And the reason it's become a social problem is because in this country, it has become so easy to transfer wealth from generations that it's a much better way to make money than it is to earn money.
Sure.
So this is something that both families really perfected. And one of the things that's interesting about the Trump is, so during the war, there was a 94% tax rate on top earners, which meant that if you were like going to be making a certain amount of money, it wasn't worth it to make any more money because you would be giving it all to the government. So people, it was a much more equal society. President Roosevelt said, paying taxes is the cost, is the dues for being a member of a civilized society. And people believed that. So there weren't that many people who were trying to evade taxes at that time. But Fred Trump was very aggressive in this early period when people believed in taxes in trying to avoid paying taxes. So it is a long-term pattern that we can see and that I talk about in the book, sort of generation to generation, wealthier people accumulating money and then using that money to influence government to get more of the things we want. And there's a direct line from that to our current moment.
One of the other things I found fascinating in the book is that you talk about what happens to individuals when they stand in Trump's way. And one particular anecdote from, I think it's the early 80s, it's the New York City Housing Commissioner. And this story was just like, what? Like, you know, you like it kind of explains.
Okay, so Roy Cohn is also involved in this story.
Of course.
And one of the things that was amazing about this book, so the epigraph of my book was written by Charles Kushner. I mean, it was said by Charles Kushner in an unpublished interview. And in it he says, no human being could write this script, only God could have. And when I started writing the book, I mean, I was writing about the early history of Trump, and there were people that were involved in that early history of Trump, like Roy Cohn and Roger Stone and Rudy Giuliani, and they show up in Act One and Act Two of my book. And I did not know when I started writing these pages that they were going to come back in Act Five and essentially be with us today. I did not know that Roy Cohn was going to show up in the Mueller report and that Donald Trump was going to be in the White House saying, where is my Roy Cohn? And that the whole concept of a lawyer like Roy Cohn was going to be very much part of our present. But Roy Cohn was involved with trying to get tax abatements for Trump Tower. And so... Trump Tower, as many of you know, is at the corner of 56th Street and 5th Avenue in Manhattan, which is not exactly a blighted location. But Donald Trump wanted to get a tax abatement for housing in blighted locations. So he told the city that he was deserving of a tax break that was designed by New York legislators to stimulate affordable housing construction, basically in poor areas. And he said, I want that. And there was a commissioner named Tony Glidman, the housing commissioner at the time, who said no. And so after he says no, he gets an anonymous phone call one morning from a guy who identifies himself as named Vinny and says, if you don't give Donald Trump his tax break, I'm going to kill you. And an NYPD detail has to protect him and his family for several months. Interestingly, that same day, Donald Trump called the FBI, and he said, I heard about a guy giving a death threat to Tony Glidman. And the transcripts of all of that are in the book. But what happens after that is Donald Trump goes after Tony Glidman in court, sues him personally, even though he's a city housing commissioner, because he wants his tax abatement. And the case goes up to the highest court in New York. Roy Cohn argues it for 7 hours, as Donald Trump says, with no notes. They win. They win the case because the law is written poorly. And they find they exploit that the law, even though it's clearly intended to stimulate affordable housing in neighborhoods like Brownsville and not Fifth Avenue and 56th Street, they get a ruling from the New York's highest court that they're entitled to the tax break. A little bit after this, Donald Trump goes to Tony Glidman and he says, will you come and have dinner at the 20 or lunch at the 21 Club? And Tony Glidman says, well, you can't take me out to lunch at the 21 Club because I can't take that as a city official. So they go and they eat in an Italian restaurant in Lower Manhattan and they each pay their own way. And Donald Trump says, will you come work for me? And Tony Glidman does. And he writes in his resignation letter that he really saw this as his chance. He was sort of he was a city commissioner with a kind of an unglamorous job and an unglamorous office. And here was this very wealthy, glamorous developer saying, come work for me. We'll do all kinds of exciting things, and you won't have to deal with all those silly city regulations. Tony Glidman does go to work for Donald Trump, and it's terrible. He gets a lot of abuse. He also gets abuse from his
former boss, Ed Koch, the mayor, who was feuding with Trump, and sort of Tony Gladden got in the middle of that. And he quits, and he goes on to do something else. And then not long after that, he dies of a stroke at a very young age. So that is the story of Tony Gladden. And one of the reasons why I put it in the book is because I just feel like the way that Donald Trump gets people to do things against their better judgment and sort of lures them in with glamour and promises of excitement, and even people who are like, I don't really know if I like Donald Trump, but I think it's going to be exciting, so why not give it a try? It's a motif that we keep seeing over and over and over again. And the best known person who got caught in a situation like this was Michael Cohen, who was also somebody who talks about how Donald Trump kept saying to him, do this thing. And he knew the thing was wrong, but he did the thing. And then once he had done that wrong thing, Donald Trump would say, do another wrong thing. And then suddenly he had done so many wrong things that he couldn't turn back. He couldn't separate himself from Donald Trump. He was tied up with him. And we see that until the things that Michael Cohen is now serving prison time for, which was making a campaign, an illegal campaign contribution at the direction of Donald Trump to pay a hush money payment to two women who said they had affairs with the president. And that's why the Tony Gladden story is an example, because I'm trying to trace back the way that Donald Trump gains power by compromising people around him.
So you did more than 100 interviews for this book, and I'm wondering, obviously Tony Gladden didn't speak to you, but did other people who had who'd gone through this experience talk to you on the record?
On the record?
Well, did you get their stories?
So there's a story about how I started writing this book, which is the editor came to me, and I had covered the Bridgegate scandal. People know the Bridgegate scandal with Chris Christie and closing off the access lanes of the George Washington Bridge. And my editor came to me and he said, why don't you write a book about the Trumps and the Kushners? Same world, same people. And I hadn't really thought about that, but then I said, oh yes, actually that is the same people and it is the same world. And it turns out, just from having reported for more than two decades, really, in New York City on corruption and also real estate, because it's just so entwined with New York government, and on New York government and on New Jersey government, there were so many people that I knew that I didn't even know I knew, that had firsthand direct experiences with these people and these two families. So it just became a question of sort of asking and figuring out and trying to know who would know. And there was a lot of history that I was able to put together. And then also I got a lot of help from journalists and historians and other people who had gone over this material. So there were many, many ways of piecing it together. I read 100,000 pages of documents for this. I can't even believe it, for this book. And I spoke to more than 200 people, maybe 10, where I said you could use my name. Because people had bad experiences. I mean, they had been, you know, their felt like their lives or their livelihoods or their reputations had been destroyed or could be destroyed. And so as somebody who's like, you know, a journalist and a writer, I mean, I didn't want to tell people otherwise. The way I combated that is got more people to talk to me so that I knew that what I was writing, even though it might not be attributed all the time, was the correct thing. Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of work. That's a lot of work. And I'm also worried, like, mental health. That's a lot of time
I did
to
a lot
spend
of yoga.
In that world.
Yeah. I really did a lot of yoga. It was good. My arms are strong.
So let's jump back over to the Kushner timeline, because, you know, the story from the escape out of Poland to the New Jersey real estate scam in the 90s yeah. and aughts is like, whoa, it's kind of a whiplash kind of thing. So what happened to that family?
Yeah, it is. It's a sad, sad story, because Joe and Ray's children end up in a family feud. Charlie Kushner, who is Jared Kushner's father, becomes a sort of very aggressive philanthropist, and he wants his name on all kinds of charities, and he starts giving political donations, very, very big political donations. He gave as much money to New Jersey Democrats at one point as Enron gave to George W. Bush. So he was a giant donor and was also on a path to really trying to seek power. He was on track to be the chairman of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which is an immensely powerful position and one that also typically conflicts with local real estate interests. And while he was on his way there, he crossed a line. He did something that, so I now under campaign finance laws, almost everything is legal. Like you can do anything you want. I think, did anybody hear the tape that was released of Trump with the donors? I mean, so much is legal now because as a result of the Citizens United and other campaign finance laws, but it's still not legal to write a donation in somebody else's name. Which is essentially what Charlie Kushner did, and his brother sued him, and an ambitious Republican prosecutor got wind of the lawsuit, a guy named Chris Christie. I'm telling you, only God could write this script. And he starts investigating him, and Charlie Kushner realizes that he's going to be caught, and he decides that his brother and his sister have cooked up the case with Chris Christie, which is not correct, but he decides he's going to put a stop to it. And the way he's going to put a stop to it is he hires a police captain to hire a sex worker to entrap his sister Esther's husband in a motel room called the Red Bull Motel. And he videotapes the encounter. And when it looks like the case is really getting serious and he's about to be indicted, he sends the tape to his sister. On the eve of her son's engagement party.
Wow.
And then Charlie Kushner, Jared Kushner's father, is arrested for witness tampering, campaign finance, and tax violations, and he pleads guilty. Unlike Donald Trump, Charlie Kushner was caught and served prison time for his actions.
Well, if any of you had tough Thanksgivings with your families, you can feel a lot better now, I think.
there's
the new bar. Yeah,
there were some very, very, very tense satyrs at the Fontainebleau in Florida, which I write about in the book.
Wow. So you mentioned Chris Christie. I mean, to your point earlier about the reoccurring characters, you've got Roy Cohn, you've got Giuliani, you've got Chris Christie, and then there's Paul Manafort.
Paul Manafort. So a story that I did on Paul Manafort was sort of one of the first major stories that I did on the sort of business interests around Trump. And the story that I did back in 2017 was that he had a series of very unusual real estate transactions, and I couldn't figure out what they were. So me and my reporting partner, Ilya Maritz, went to talk to a bunch of experts, and we said, why would you do this? And they said, the typical reason why you would do that is if you were laundering money. Paul Manafort did launder money. But anyway, we did this story, and I hit one of the houses where he laundered money. It's maybe 10 minutes from my house. And so I rode over to look at his house, and I write this scene at the beginning of the introduction, and I read it as, at the time, I thought it was just a parable about me and my ignorance of what was going on, because the money that he used to buy his Brooklyn brownstone came from the corrupt strongman president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. This is on page one of my introduction. No kidding. When I wrote it, Paul Manafort was on trial. The jury was out. I had no idea what was going to happen. But I wrote it because it was an example to me of how foreign wealth had been rushing in to our banking system and to our campaign finance system. And I had studied corruption and money in politics for 20 years, and I had no idea that it was right there, right in my neighborhood. Mm. And that's why I started the book with Paul Manafort. I didn't know that we would be talking about Ukraine today, right now. And, I mean, many of you know this, but it was the reason that Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani first went to Ukraine was because of this case, because they wanted to undermine the evidence that Paul Manafort had received this money from in this illegal way, because they felt it was the whole start of the so-called Russia hoax, and that if they could undermine the prosecution and dig up dirt and muddy it and make people confused about it, that somehow it would exonerate Trump. And I finished the book. I had to hand it in on September 30th. September 19th is when the Ukraine scandal broke. So the last chapter of the book is really up to the minute. And, you know, only God could write this script. Ukraine comes back. It's there on page one, and it's there at the end of Act 5. I know people here probably, like, are in the movie industry, and, like, you know, you would probably tell me, like, it's too obvious. It's, like, tied together too much. But...
Well,
it's all true.
I'll ask, I'll kind of speed forward here because I want to make sure that the audience has time for questions. But, okay, so these two families merge in 2009 in Bedminster, the beautiful wedding of Jared and Ivana.
And, Ivanka.
Oh, sorry. Ivanka. And then they basically, Jared gets to the White House with his father-in-law, and they both begin... supporting these policies that would, you know, that the policies that allowed their families to come to America to thrive. It's like there's a concerted effort to basically tear them down one by one.
Yeah.
Why? What is that about?
Well, I mean, I think what it is about is they are, you know, the story is an emblematic story of our times, but an emblematic families, but not typical families. And they have made a set of choices to enhance their own power and own wealth, and they still do it. And it's a seamless line from what they did in the real estate industries in New York and New Jersey to what is happening in the White House, where we can tell by the things that Donald Trump says every day that he does not draw distinctions between his personal business and the government and his family's interests, and they're all tied together. So in their minds, they believe they are advancing their family's interests, which we just heard Trump's lawyer say yesterday, well, anything that Trump wants to do must be in the national interest. There's it's official government pronounced policy that there are no walls between these things. So that's what they believe they are doing. They believe, you know, when Jared Kushner is asked about his grandparents, he tells a success story. He sees it as a story of success, not a story about refugees and immigrants. And I tried to speak to him. I mean, I asked to speak to him and Ivanka and Donald Trump and Charlie Kushner. The Trumps basically ignored me. The Kushners, I sent Jared Kushner 83 questions. I sent his father many, many questions, and I got a few answers. But one of the questions was, how do you reconcile national refugee policy with your own family story of misrepresenting ties in order to immigrate so that you, Jared Kushner, could become so successful? And he didn't answer. Time magazine asked him about it recently, and his answer was, you will never hear me criticize my father-in-law. So, I mean, that is what Jared Kushner has to say about it. And I think, you know, there's a lot of things about the book that are confusing and that I really try to wrestle with. And I try to sort of let the events and characters and stories tell themselves. So some of it, I think people are just going to have to come to their own conclusions about how it came to be by reading the book.
Well, I was saying to you in the room before we came on here that, you know, you grow up, if you grow up in American schools, you're taught that, you know, you can be president. The iconic American presidents are the Abe Lincolns, the Born in the Log Cabin,
right.
Honest Abe, or, you know, even Bill Clinton, who worked his way up from his bootstraps. And it's all about working hard, doing the right thing. And after this book, I thought the real iconic American president.
Yeah.
It's
another story about ourselves. And, you know, I think just going back to Jared Kushner's grandmother, Ray Kushner, one of the things I've asked is what are the stories that we tell ourselves about what can happen and what cannot happen? And I think that there are some very important lessons. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that we are constantly finding ourselves victims of in this country is failure of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And it's something that Donald Trump has so expertly played upon, because he plays to people's dreams and what they want to believe. And that is why he meets with success again and again, although, of course, we don't know how successful because we haven't seen his tax returns.
Well, I think we're ready for some audience questions. We have microphones out in the crowd, so you guys will call on them. I would just remind, you know, it's tempting to weigh in and with commentary. Questions are more helpful because they're questions.
Thank you for a fascinating discussion. Everything you described about Donald Trump and everything I know about the man is he's a sociopath. Is there anything that you came across in your research that would disabuse me of that notion?
Well, I think I'll let you read the book and answer that. I mean, I know that there are a lot of people who are sort of have given psychological diagnoses. I am not a psychologist. I will just say the way he behaves in the White House and behaved as a businessman is that, you know, and it's a sort of America first kind of a way. It's the Trump family first. And the repercussions of that, I mean, I think we see all around us.
I've got a copy of your book.
Thank you.
I read books backwards. I go into the index to find what I'm interested in. In this case, I looked at Trump University.
Mm.
Now, Trump University operated a scam in the state of California, the state of New York, the state of Florida, and the state of Texas. And if you go on Wikipedia, it gives you a very good background.
Or you could read about it in American Oligarch.
Yes. But the one question I have, why didn't the FBI investigate Trump University?
Well, it's a really interesting thing, and I really talk a lot about how Trump really managed to fend off federal investigations in a variety of ways. So sometimes he would threaten people, and sometimes he would cajole people, and sometimes he would take FBI agents out to golf outings. Sometimes he would take prosecutors out to lunch or fly in on his helicopter and make a display of power. In the case of Trump University, there were a series of contributions that were questionable made to locals' attorneys general. The New York Attorney General did sue Trump, and there's a section in my book where I talk about how I tell this story from Ivanka Trump's perspective, because she filed a complaint saying that the Attorney General had tried to shake her down for contributions so he wouldn't prosecute her, and then when she didn't give him contributions, he filed the lawsuit. Now, I know from my research that people really lost out from Trump University, and many of the people in New York, I'm sure in California too, were ashamed. And when they finally did get called by investigators, they broke down and cried because they had been too embarrassed to tell their stories. And basically, the story was that it wasn't Trump University, and they had thought that they were getting something. They thought that they were going to get Donald Trump's real estate expertise, but all of the promises that he made were not fulfilled, and they lost their money, and many of them, they lost their life savings. But the interesting thing about Ivanka Trump's telling of this story in this affidavit, which is sort of long lost, is she describes how very rich people in New York interact with prosecutors and public officials and how making contributions was part of their world. One of the very interesting things in it is that Ivanka Trump says that she did things at the behest of Eric Schneiderman, who had his own scandal and resigned, but who was the Attorney General. But she talks about how he kept asking her to do things, and one of the things he asked her to do is go to a fundraiser for Kamala Harris. And there is a check in this complaint written from Donald Trump to Kamala Harris, which she says she did because she felt like if she didn't, Eric Schneiderman would unreasonably sue them. Eric Schneiderman did sue them, and right before he became president, Trump Organization settled for $25 million.
I have a question. Two questions, really short. How did Fred Trump get away from the Senate Banking Committee investigation? You said he made it through, but how did he make it through?
Well, because you know, there was no criminal consequence for his action. So they just wrote a report saying this was a terrible practice, we disagree, but they didn't really change any of the structures that would have prevented it from happening again.
Outside the scope of your book, but these powerful families, the Kennedys, the Bushes, the Kennedy family has been very quiet in the middle of all this. These families manifest themselves in any other way? Because it sounds like it's a lot of powerful families moving around politically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Trumps and the Kushners are really a unique example. I mean, obviously, as you point out, there are wealthy families that have had enormous influence in U.S. politics forever. But what is different now is that these families, who really corroded the campaign finance system, and, you know, the founders, I don't know if anybody's been listening to the impeachment hearings today, but there was a lot of talk about the founders. And one of the things that I learned from what I was reporting in my book is that they were so concerned about corruption that, and they believed that corruption was as big a threat to the Republic as war. And they also believed that people were going to have corrupt desires. So you couldn't change the way people would feel, but you could create systems, which meant that they couldn't act on those desires. So one of the things I've learned about the way these families acted is that they broke down those walls from inside the system. And then when they came in the White House, they broke them down even more so that it becomes easier for other people to corrupt the system. So there are just so many deals. I mean, I think I read about three new ones today where private people give a lot of money and they have an audience with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago or at his hotel, and they get something from him that they want. And that is not the way the system's supposed to work. I mean, I know people think like, oh, there's quite a few people who feel that the system is corrupt, it's rotten, they're just one example. But having spent all of this intense time studying them and also having studied a lot of corruption, they are off the charts.
Hi, thank you. So I'm a huge fan of the Trump Inc. podcast.
Oh, thank you.
And I've been listening to it from episode one. And I wondered...
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you.
It's fantastic if y'all don't listen to it. But of all of the Trump Inc. podcasts, of all the stories that you've reported on, which is the one, of all the things you've uncovered, which is the one that has made you the angriest, that you think is the most shocking?
Oh, wow. Huh. I mean... I feel like, you know, it's sort of like anger is not necessarily the emotion because, like, I'm trying to, like, do the research and tell the story. I mean, I think one of the things that's amazing to us is that, does anybody listen to the podcast Serial? Okay, so, you know, in Serial, they're like, previously. Which, like, we were not really doing, like, a true crime podcast. We were just doing a story about the president's business practices. But then this fall, we started to do that previously on Trump Inc. because the storyline started running together. And I think that that was the most amazing moment when we did previously on Trump Inc. talking about how Don Jr. was promulgating a conspiracy theory about Hunter Biden on the same day that Marie Yovanovitch was testifying to Congress. And that was what the story was about as these storylines came together, the different things that we had covered, conspiracy theories, tax fraud, Ukraine, and just the sort of raw assertion of power. And I think that that was the sort of probably the craziest moment when we suddenly realized that we were doing a true crime podcast in real time, which was not exactly what we, I mean, we didn't know. No one had been indicted when we started.
Ah, the salad days.
Hi, also a big fan of your
oh,
podcast.
Thank you.
A lot of the talk is about the men in the oligarchies and the generations. Mm. I'm wondering if you'd speak a little bit about the women and their roles. And I know there's a couple key ones, of course, that you've mentioned, but what is the women's role? How do they build up support and develop the oligarchies?
The most powerful woman in all of this is Ivanka Trump, and who is a big, big character in the book. Jared Kushner's grandmother, Ray Kushner, was very involved in the family business, although, you know, she also was in charge of raising the family, but she sort of kept the books. And Joe Kushner was driving around. He did a lot of business out of his car because he was very frugal. But these really are patriarchal families. And the Kushner family is a modern Orthodox family. And men in these situations are more powerful. And that, I think, is, I mean, the Trump family is also a very patriarchal family. So it's not like the women weren't powerful and didn't have influence, and I do write about them. But in terms of sort of the control and the power and the business, it is held by the men. And there's a long section where I talk about Donald Trump and Ivana Trump and their prenup that was written by Roy Cohn, where she really lost out.
Yeah, I'm just wondering where the two families first intersect. Is it when Jared and Ivanka meet up, or is it some point earlier?
I mean, basically, yes, in terms of like their business interests and coming together. They were in the same world. So there were a lot of people that they interacted with that were the same people, and they sort of were circling around each other. But when they connected was when Jared and Ivanka got together. And the book starts with their wedding, because a wedding is a great way to start a multi-generational story. It's a moment of drama when a thing happens before you. And also it's a story about the marriage of money and power. So it seemed logical to start with a marriage.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I really recommend this book. Please read it.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.